And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. The time right now is 6 o'clock, and we want to welcome you to WORT's local news for Monday, April 21st, 2025. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. In tonight's news,
the state Supreme Court narrowly upholds Governor Evers' partial veto that secures a school funding bump for the next 400 years.
Madison joined in Saturday for another National Day of Action organized by the group 5051.
And in the second half, we'll examine the background of politics of SCOTUS's long-serving justice, celebrate Belcasa La Follette's birthday, and review two new features.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Today's news.
This is the BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The world's 1.4 billion Roman Catholics are mourning the loss of Pope Francis, their spiritual leader for the past 12 years. He died early on Monday from a stroke and heart failure after weeks of poor health. Prayers had been said at the Vatican, where Pope Francis gave his Easter blessing on Sunday. Marianne Moshiri is there.
In many ways, he was the first. For example, he was the first pope from the Americas. He was the first pope to be a Jesuit pope. He was also the first pope from the Southern Hemisphere. And if you go back to his choice of name when he was first announced all the way back in 2013 after the retirement of Pope Benedict XVI, he chose the name Francis after Saint Francis of Assisi, one of the saints who really championed the poor. He loved animals, he felt strongly about the environment, and those are some of the themes that Pope Francis kept going during his papacy.
Francis travelled the world during 60 foreign tours and owned up to the church's child sex abuse failings. No date has been set for the Pope's funeral, but it's expected to take place within a week. His coffin will first lie in state in St Peter's Basilica. The conclave to elect a successor will not begin for at least 15 days. 135 cardinals are eligible to vote. Most were appointed by Francis. In Argentina, the Pope's homeland, President Javier Milei, who once branded Francis the devil's representative, said their differences now seemed minor and it had been an honour to know him. The Football Association postponed all Monday's fixtures, noting the Pope never hid his passion for the game. Our Latin America correspondent is Will Grant.
It was hoped, I think, by many Argentines that he would visit the nation at some point during his papacy. That didn't come to pass. Perhaps he was hesitant of getting drawn into the very polarised national politics and didn't want to be seen siding with one side or the other. But of course, there he's held in great regard. One of the country's greatest sons, and 7 days of national mourning have been announced.
In Mexico, President Claudia Sheinbaum described Francis as an advocate for peace and equality. Speaking in St. Peter's Square in Rome, our regional editor Aline McBull gave this assessment.
This was a pope who wanted to reach out to people in the peripheries of the Catholic world, but also reach out to people outside the Catholic Church, and particularly to those on the margins, those who were affected by the rich and powerful about the world, around the world, who didn't have a voice, vehemently anti-war as well.
That was our religion editor, Aline McBull. You're listening to The World News from the BBC. President Trump has stood behind his embattled defence secretary, dismissing as fake news reports that Pete Hegseth shared sensitive information on a second chat group, this time including his wife, brother and personal lawyer. Mr Trump said he was doing a great job. The shared information related to the same attack on Houthi rebels in Yemen, the details of which were inadvertently leaked to the editor of The Atlantic magazine. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has met the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Delhi for talks. Mr. Modi's office said that significant progress had been made towards agreeing a trade deal and that the two men discussed boosting cooperation in energy and defence. India is hoping to secure a deal to avoid steep US tariffs. President Zelensky says Russia needs to give a clear answer about whether it will accept Ukraine's proposal not to strike civilian infrastructure. Mr. Zelensky added Ukraine was ready for any conversation with about how a 30-day ceasefire could be achieved. Earlier, President Putin said Ukraine's suggestion needed to be carefully assessed. In his nightly address, Mr. Zelensky said Russia alone had the key to halting the war.
Now, after Easter, the whole world sees the real issue, the true reason why the fighting continues. It's Russia that's the source of the war. It's Moscow that must order the Russian army to cease fire. If such an order is not given, there is no silence.
Russian state media is reporting that a journalist who faced up to 10 years in prison for criticizing the army has escaped house arrest. Ekaterina Barabash, a critic of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, failed to attend a court hearing in a town near St. Petersburg, and her whereabouts are unknown. Ms. Barabash has been declared a wanted fugitive. BBC News.
Good evening, this is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers and Republican leaders in the state legislature had held a meeting last month to discuss the possibility of a new tax plan as part of their ongoing negotiations surrounding the state budget, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. At stake is whether the legislature will release a tax cut bill outside of the state budget package. Such a bill would most likely be vetoed by the governor, as it would remove one of the key negotiating points in his proposed budget. Currently, the state is running a $4 billion budget surplus, which Republicans want to disperse in the form of tax cuts, and Democrats want to use to buttress public spending. Looming over the budget negotiations is the upcoming governor election in 2026. It is unclear whether Republicans want to hand Evers a budgetary win that includes tax cuts and spending increases heading into what is likely to be a closely contested election.
The Wisconsin Department of Instruction has declined to certify its compliance to a ban on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, according to the Wisconsin Examiner. The Trump administration's Department of Education had previously sent a letter asking state agencies to certify that they were in compliance with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which the Supreme Court recently ruled extended to race-based admission programs in higher education. Wisconsin's DPI pushed back on the request, asking the Department of Education to clarify what legal authority it had to make the request a condition of federal aid, a threat that the federal department had included in its letter. This is broadly in line with other states run by Democrats, which have viewed the letter as federal overreach. At stake is nearly $850 million in federal aid, around 8% of total funding for schools across the state. The funding is especially critical for school districts that serve poorer parts of the state, where federal funding makes up a larger portion of their budget.
The Evers administration released a memo last week detailing how state employees should respond to immigration officials or other federal law enforcement officers showing up at their workplace, according to the Associated Press. The memo instructs state employees to not answer questions, not allow immigration agents into non-public areas without a warrant, and to contact their office's attorney. The guidance is broadly in line with other instructions on how to deal with ICE agents put out by other organizations. Wisconsin Republicans have criticized the memo, saying that it makes it harder for ICE agents to do their job. Previously, Governor Evers had vetoed a bill that would have required county sheriffs to comply with federal immigration enforcement agents.
Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development continues to reject unemployment claims from laid-off workers who also collect disability benefits, according to the Wisconsin Examiner. Last year, a federal judge ruled that a 2013 Wisconsin law that blocked disability recipients from also collecting unemployment insurance violated the American with Disabilities Act, as it singled out people with disabilities to not receive state benefits. However, the Department of Workforce Development has not updated their policies to come into compliance with that ruling. The lawsuit has unresolved issues surrounding the class of people who brought the suit, and lawyers for the Department of Workforce Development have argued that the decision is not yet final.
Wisconsin legislators have introduced a bill that would ban Wisconsinites from using money from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, to purchase candy or soda, according to the Capital Times. Historically, anti-poverty groups have opposed similar measures, saying they punish poor people for being poor, and that there's little evidence that these measures lead to healthy eating. A similar measure had passed the state assembly in 2015, but was not signed into law. Legislators are also considering a bill that would prohibit schools that participate in the free and reduced price lunch program from serving meals that contain certain additives. It is unclear how widely used those additives are, and two of them are already banned by the FDA.
The Madison Police Department is set to adopt a policy that would shield underage drinkers that had called for help in a medical emergency, according to Wisconsin Public Radio. The new policy is set to take effect on Tuesday and would bring underage drinking in line with other violations protected under the Good Samaritan law. People who have provided alcohol to underage drinkers are not protected under the new policy and could still be subject to citations. The new policy would also stop someone from being cited for underage drinking if they were the victim of a crime.
The Madison Parks Department has deemed the 6 tennis courts at Vilas Park are beyond repair and need to be demolished, according to the Wisconsin State Journal. The courts were closed last year after the city's risk manager deemed them unsafe. The current plan for the park calls for them to be replaced by a mix of tennis courts, pickleball courts, and a basketball court. But it is unclear when the city will allocate funds to build the replacements.
The city of Madison also announced that it had successfully cleaned up a sewage overflow that had occurred over on the city's east side on Friday morning. 300 gallons of sewage had spilled from a sanitary access structure at the corner of Acewood Boulevard and Goldfinch Drive. The city said that the incident was caused by tree roots in the sewer that caused a blockage. Those were the headlines, and now on to today's top stories.
Governor Evers' headline-grabbing veto from 2 summers ago remains standing after the state Supreme Court's decision last Friday. WORT News producer Faye Parks has more.
The case hinged not just on the governor's partial veto powers, but on a specific veto 2 years ago in the biennial budget. That's when Governor Evers removed a handful of digits. Instead of securing a funding bump for school districts for 2 years, he secured a $325 increase for the next 400 years. Wisconsin's governor has the most expansive veto power of any state in the nation, and both parties have been eyeing this ruling as work on the state's next biennial budget begins. Split down ideological lines, the state Supreme Court's 4-3 ruling on Friday upheld Governor Evers' move. That locks in an annual school funding increase for the next 400 years. Evers celebrated the ruling in a statement last Friday. He said he used the same line item veto that Wisconsin governors have used for decades. Republicans are less pleased. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says the decision gives the governor unchecked power to raise property taxes for hundreds of years. Last December, he told Wisconsini that if the state Supreme Court upheld the veto, school districts shouldn't expect any new funding in the budget.
If it is a 400-year veto, it means there's an automatic increase for school that's built in. Legislature doesn't have to do anything, and they already get an increase. So if that's the way it's going to be, it probably means we don't have to put any more money into education because that's already covered by Governor Evers' veto.
He'd go on to outline other priorities for budget spending, like transportation and Medicaid funding. Wisconsin's permissive partial veto power dates back to a 1930 constitutional amendment that allowed the governor to do exactly this in budgets. That veto power has narrowed somewhat in the last 35 years, thanks to a series of legal challenges and constitutional amendments. Voters approved a constitutional amendment in 1990 that bars so-called Vanna White vetoes, which removes the governor's ability to strike individual letters to make entirely new words. Still allowed are Frankenstein vetoes, which allows the governor to delete words and create a whole other meaning. Scott Rosenau, the attorney representing the state legislature, argued before the state Supreme Court last fall that Evers' 400-year veto violated that 1990 amendment, even if he struck out numbers instead of letters in this case.
So let's say somebody witnesses a hit and run and calls the police. Police officer shows up. He's going to say, "Did you get the license plate number?" He doesn't mean just the digits. He means the letters and digits on the plate. So that obviously that goes the other way, where numbers referring to letters. But I think it really goes both ways, that letters and numbers, words and digits, are all largely pretty interchangeable. And as an example, 10, T-E-N, that's a word. 10 also means 10. They mean the exact same thing. One is just written in fewer characters.
Liberal Justice Anne Walsh Bradley agreed this fall that 400 years is an absurd extension of one provision in a two-year budget.
But equally absurd to me is your argument that a letter is a number, or vice versa, that a number is a letter. I think it doesn't take a constitutional expert or what they refer to as a Philadelphia lawyer, a fourth grader, or dare I say a four-year-old, knows the difference between letters and numbers. And so it seems to me my response is almost visceral. I don't care how many fancy words or legal theories you put behind it to make it sound like it's erudite. Four is not a letter of the alphabet.
But justices were equally skeptical this fall of the argument defending the 400-year veto. Attorneys representing the governor argued that he didn't violate state law because after the line item veto, the final result was still a complete and workable piece of legislation. They also argued that the veto didn't overstep the bounds set in previous rulings in the state Supreme Court. Conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley challenged the latter, arguing that Republican and Democratic governors have exploited the veto power in the past, and it's time for the court to revisit the issue.
All sides have done this. They have tested the limits. They have pushed the limits. Arguably, I think, as I've written, have exceeded the limits that the Constitution puts on the governor's power. The argument that you're making is, well, you know, court, you historically have blessed this, so you must continue to bless it. I don't buy that, because what has happened is the governor is becoming the most powerful person in this state, arguably, to just make the law whatever he declares.
But attorney Colin Roth countered that this case wasn't the time to draw the line, especially when there are other options on the table.
Precisely because there are safeguards on the power, on the partial veto power, aside from litigation like this. Again, there's override votes, there's constitutional amendments, there's technical means of drafting legislation to dodge this. There's taking the policy out of the budget bill. Those are four ways in which this kind of problem can be avoided that doesn't bring this, as much as I like getting together with you all, that doesn't bring us here.
The 4-3 ruling on Friday sides with the governor. Liberal Justice Jill Karofsky writes in the majority opinion that while the 400-year modification is significant, the state constitution doesn't limit the governor's partial veto based on how much it changes policy. Conservative Justice Brian Hagedorn writes in the minority opinion that allowing this partial veto gives the governor too much power, that he can cross out whatever he pleases, and quote, presto, out comes a new law never considered or passed by the legislature at all. And there you have it, a governor who can propose and enact law all on his own, unquote. Meanwhile, state lawmakers are in the process of drafting the next biennial budget. This latest ruling may only complicate partisan negotiations. For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's now 6:18 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
This last Saturday was another national day of action organized by the nationwide group 5051. While other cities across the country held marches, that wasn't quite the case here in Madison. Instead, local organizers decided to host a buy-in event at the Dane County Farmers Market. WORT reporter Shayna Clark headed out to James Madison Park on Saturday, where she spoke with Anna Gerard with the Madison Resistance Coalition.
Can you just describe for me what's happening here and what this protest is all about?
Absolutely. So, as you probably know, we had the National 5051 on the 5th. We had a huge rally up at the Capitol. And today was the next day of action that they called. So we were a little bit worried about, a huge crowd showing up at the Capitol during the market. So what we wanted to do today, because they called for a community action day as well as protesting, so what we wanted to do is turn it into more of a community building space today instead of like a full-fledged protest, and help the farmers who have had their funding cut and help out low-income families in Madison too. So HFFA is Healthy Food for All, and they will take everything after our event today and go distribute that around the city. So
okay, and then I know it's titled Buy Out the Market. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, so it's funny you mentioned that, because we had originally thought of doing like trunks for tariffs, so like sort of like a trunk or treat style thing, but we were having trouble sourcing goods. So instead we decided to kind of flip the script and have, you know, people help buy out the market instead of asking for donations from organizations. And then we partnered with Joe, who had a system in place already with his Buy One for a Neighbor events. So, you know, sort of a don't reinvent the wheel kind of thing. So yeah, we just, you know, kind of married together very beautifully, and here we are. So
what message are you trying to send with this organizing today?
Yeah, so I guess my message for today is the hope that like people will step up and start helping to organize more and just get more involved in the organizing and the activism side of things. Because, you know, it's one thing to go to a rally and yell and be, you know, loud. It's a whole other animal to organize, and we need more people involved, especially if we're going to make change.
I guess on that note, what specific changes would you like to see in response to this kind of community action?
I guess I would really just like to see more people involved in like more organizing, you know? Like today we have some signs for some affinity groups. So we have veterans, LGBT, workers' rights, and business owners, women, things like that. And what we are hoping for is to get these people together, who the things they care about very deeply, and just have them start to come up with like brainstorming and think about ways that they can make, you know, impact on a higher level than just coming to a protest. So
I guess just to kind of backtrack a little, I'm curious to know if farmers or vendors who are at the Capitol right now, are they aware of what's going on, and did you guys kind of give them some information?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We've been in contact for the last week and a half with all of the management, with the state capitol police, permitting, with parks, and yeah, everybody's aware. And the vendors were all told, they were all, you know, bringing extra food, and we had a couple vendors make us a whole bunch of cinnamon rolls for the volunteers. They're very excited. So we're really hoping to make this a more regular thing and just help kind of create a self-sustaining food system here.
So overall, was it mostly positive reactions, or did you get a little like pushback from anybody?
Yeah, there was some pushback online, mostly because, you know, people wanted to really like rally at the Capitol, which is fair, and I understand that. But, you know, with the farmers market happening, there's a lot of extra like red tape and permitting that we just couldn't quite get in the time frame we had. So we're going to have a meeting next week with all those people and with, you know, the organizers of this event, and try and find a better solution. Maybe move the rallies later in the day after the market or something of that sort, so that they can still happen, because we want to be able to provide people that space. But, you know, just like given the time frame, and honestly, my time in activism so far, I've only been doing this like 2 weeks. So it's a big learning curve, you know, so we're working on it, but we'll have better solutions moving forward. Yeah.
I'm also a little curious about the people behind the big national like 50-51. I guess so this is part of like a broader movement.
Yeah. So the 50-51 movement is sort of a is sort of an umbrella, right, as I've been told. And basically what that means, right, it's a decentralized movement. So there isn't really anyone, like, quote, in charge. Anybody can step up and organize anything. Anybody can, you know, any group can organize. Groups can partner and do it under the umbrella of 5051 or in association. It's a little like, you know, anybody can take charge, which I think is cool. So I've established a coalition, and we chose today with the, you know, the next National Day of Action to organize this, you know, in association with 5051.
And then how are you guys getting the word out about movements like this and future protests and events?
Yeah, so I have a link tree, and it has a link for my coalition Discord, which again is very new. So it's not fleshed out as much as I'd like it to be yet, but we'll get there. And then it's got another collective who one of their members has been helping me organize this. He's been an amazing, amazing help this week. And then we've got 5051, Healthy Food for All. And then we have a link to a protest that's coming up on Earth Day. And then within my Discord server, I have a section to talk about like my coalition's events that we're planning and working with, and other groups' events as well. So I want to provide that as a resource for people to find other stuff too.
Why, in your own words, would you say that community action like this and mutual aid initiatives, why is that important?
Yeah, I think particularly like food security is a big, big thing that, you know, can make or break a community, right? I think it's so important to make sure that people are fed and farmers can keep growing their crops to help provide for the community. I really want to help to create a self-sustaining food system here in Dane County, and then hopefully, you know, greater Wisconsin from there.
If you had one message to send to people in our community, what message would that be?
Just stay strong, get involved. You know, we need more people, and you know, this current administration is just steamrolling the checks and balances. Like, protesting just isn't going to cut it anymore. We need to do more. We need to do more community building, community action, and mutual aid to keep ourselves protected and make real change.
And then is there anything I didn't touch on or ask you about that you'd like to share with people?
I just want to say thank you to everybody who's come out. Like, this is crazier than anything I could have imagined, and I feel so, so grateful and so blessed to be able to do this for my community. And you know, just, I couldn't do it without everybody who came to the protest here and to who donated, you know.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Shana Clark.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll examine the background of politics of SCOTUS's longest-serving justice. We'll celebrate Belle Case La Follette's birthday, and we'll review two new features.
But now we're going to take a quick break and then check in on some world headlines. Don't touch that radio dial. We'll be right back.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
Hello, this is Evan Vodak, lead singer of the band Voltsia. We are a rock and heavy metal band from Madison, and letting you know to tune in this Monday, April 21st, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Wart 89.9 FM Access Hour for a full live performance. Also, the last 10 minutes will be saved to hear more about our upcoming shows and our new single, Love No Human, and more. Thank you very much.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The world's 1.4 billion Roman Catholics are mourning the loss of Pope Francis, their spiritual leader for the past 12 years. The 88-year-old died early on Monday after weeks of poor health. Prayers have been said for Pope Francis at the Vatican, where he gave his Easter blessing on Sunday, in his native Argentina and in countless churches across the world. In accordance with his will, Pope Francis will be buried in a simple tomb in the earth in the Basilica of St. Mary Major in Rome. It will bear a one-word inscription, Franciscus, his name in Latin. Dozens of world leaders will attend his funeral, expected within a week. President Trump said he and his wife would be present, calling Francis a good man. Russia's Vladimir Putin praised his sense of justice, while President Mahmoud Abbas said Palestinians had lost a friend. Argentina has decreed 7 days of national mourning. President Javier Milei, who once branded Francis the devil's representative, said their differences now seemed minor. The Argentine Football Association postponed all Monday's fixtures, noting that the Pope never hid his passion for the game. In other news, Harvard University, America's richest, has sued the Trump administration for freezing more than $2 billion in funding. It has refused to bow to pressure from President Trump, who's furious with Harvard and several other universities for rejecting government supervision. President Zelensky says Russia needs to give a clear answer about whether it will accept Ukraine's proposal not to strike civilian infrastructure. He said Ukraine was ready for any conversation about a ceasefire. And Russian state media is reporting that a journalist who faced up to 10 years in prison for criticising the army has escaped house arrest. Ekaterina Barabash was an outspoken critic of the invasion of Ukraine. BBC News.
The time is just about 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Rachel Fields, here with my co-host, Sam Swartz. Thanks for joining us.
Clarence Thomas is now the longest tenured member of the United States Supreme Court. First appointed to the country's highest court in 1991 by President H.W. Bush, Thomas's appointment hearings grew bitter and heated over Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment. Thomas won appointment in the Senate by a 52-48 margin. Among the senators voting to confirm was Democrat Joe Biden of Delaware. In his 34 years on the bench, Thomas has gained a reputation as the court's most conservative member. He's also recently developed a reputation by some as corrupt, having received multiple favors from wealthy conservatives with interests before the United States Supreme Court. Corey Robin is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and author of The Enigma of Clarence Thomas, The Reactionary Mind and Fear. Robin says there's more to Thomas than meets the eye, and you underestimate his jurisprudence at your own peril. He spoke with WORT's Brian Standing ahead of his Humanities Without Borders guest lecture this Thursday at UW-Madison.
You talk about a number of cliches about Thomas, but you say that there's aspects of his political philosophy that many liberals would agree with. And explain that, because it's hard for many people to imagine someone who's voted against affirmative action, voted against abortion, been a staunch defender of the Second Amendment rights. It's hard to imagine that there's much in common with current liberal thought.
Well, you have to start by knowing a little bit about Thomas's background and where he comes from and what he used to think before he became a justice on the court. Thomas really begins as a Black nationalist on the left, and he makes a slow migration to the right, but he never loses certain key assumptions of that Black nationalism from his younger days. One of those assumptions is that racism is a permanent fact of American politics and American life and the American economy. It's not going away. White people will always be racist. And I think that's the first thing that Thomas shares with parts of the left is that racism is an ineradicable fact. The second is that racism will always color everything that the U.S. government does, the American state does. And I think there you also see some very similar beliefs. And the third, and here's where he departs from the left, but I think parts of the left could still nevertheless find this intelligible, is that he thinks that all political efforts to remediate the position of Black people are ultimately somewhat hopeless because they're bounded by these hard facts of white supremacy. So I think that's the deep underlying pessimism about racial progress that I think he has a certain kind of an affinity with parts of the left.
So let's talk about that background. I mean, you mentioned he started as a leftist Black nationalist. I think for many people that's kind of hard to fathom. Where did he come from and where did he develop that sensibility?
He's born he comes from the South. He comes from Georgia. But in 1968, he comes north to the College of Holy Cross. And I think that journey north for him was a real shocker. Thomas, and this is all from his own personal testimony and memoirs and writing, it's all very consistent. Thomas was very familiar with the obvious color line in the South, with white supremacists who didn't put a smile on their faces. And when he comes to the North, he encounters a different side of white racism. The people with smiling faces who tell lies. That's a famous song from the early 70s that was one of his favorite songs, as it turns out. And in that encounter with Northern racism, what we might call liberal racism, the kind of seemingly benevolent, seemingly well-meaning, but nevertheless still believing in Black inequality, in his encounter with that, he is drawn towards the writings and speeches of Malcolm X. He had records of all of those speeches. That's how people back then used to hear things that they hadn't heard live. And he memorized those speeches. He could still recite lines from them well into the 1980s, if not beyond. And he took from Malcolm X this idea that when it comes to white people, your biggest enemy, the one you should be most worried about, is not the white wolf with obvious fangs, but the white fox. From Malcolm X, he becomes much, much more of a militant Black nationalist, Black separatist, saying that you just cannot rely upon white people for much of anything. You have to really look to the Black community. So he finds a real inspiration in Malcolm X and helps found the Black Student Union at Holy Cross. He's the secretary treasurer of it. And they really have a very strong Afrocentric, fairly separatist idea of Black student politics. And he's very active. This isn't just incidental kind of activism. He's very committed. People remember him that way. He helps lead one of the major events on that campus during that time. He leads a Black student walkout where they just simply leave the campus in protest over a racist incident on campus. He really develops this Black separatist philosophy, which he will eventually lose the more activist elements and certainly the more progressive and left elements, but will keep certain ideas of the separatism and certain ideas about Black male leadership that will still remain very important to him.
One of the things Thomas is renowned for in the court is having little respect for precedent, as shown in the Dobbs decision, where he voted in the majority to throw out many, many, many years of precedent and subsequent court decisions simply on the basis that he felt it didn't meet the Constitution.
And this is something that, in fact, Scalia would gently mock him for, was that Scalia, I can't remember the exact quote, but Scalia, when it came to this question of precedent, Scalia said, "I'm an originalist, but I'm not crazy." You know, he, Thomas, is crazy. He really is willing to kind of go the full nine yards. But yeah, this is what he's been known for quite some time, is just going through one precedent after another and tossing them out. what's been interesting, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that when he does these things, people oftentimes dismiss them as crazy, and which he may very well be. But what ends up happening is that those moves to toss out precedents slowly but surely start commanding a majority on the Supreme Court. And ultimately, you get decisions that nobody would have anticipated.
You described his racial philosophy as talked about racism always existing. There's not a lot that government can do about that. It sounds almost like a nihilist kind of view. Is he sort of a nihilist?
I can totally see why you would say that. And I understand. You know, yeah, I can see that. I don't think so. Ultimately, what pulls him back from nihilism, although it can come awfully close to that, is a term that you see all over his writing, which is about the survival of the Black community. Earlier generations of Black freedom struggle folks really believed in the transformation of America. They believed in the possibility of emancipation for Black people. Thomas does not believe in progress. He doesn't believe in advance. He doesn't really believe in emancipation. What he is most struck by in Black American history, which I should point out, he is very familiar with. Scholars of African American history have noted this before, and whom he cites in his decisions. He really knows Black American history. But what he takes from Black American history is that this group of people, Black people, survived against institutions that he himself has called totalitarian institutions. Rather than being a nihilist, he's more of a survivalist, which frankly can be equally terrifying in certain situations. And I think it's that survivalism, frankly, that explains some of his positions on the right to bear arms, which he roots in the Reconstruction era, where arming of Black men was considered to be the condition for the survival of Black families and Black communities. And he really takes his cues from these very dark moments of American history where Black people survive, don't thrive, don't flourish, but survive. Often, he believes, because of the strength of Black men, which is the other really important feature of his philosophy. He is not an egalitarian. So when we say he's a Black nationalist or Black separatist, it's not because he believes in equality. He doesn't. He really believes in the superiority of Black men, in particular over Black women. The survival of Black men and the fate of Black people for Thomas is dependent upon the survival and the fate of Black men.
Why is it important to know this about Thomas?
I think there's two reasons, one for legal reasons and one for political reasons. And I'm more interested, to be honest, in the second than the first. I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar. But the legal reason is something we touched on slightly earlier, which is that Thomas is often very much in front of the court. And if you're trying to develop a long-term strategy, if you're trying to think of where things are going, keeping an eye on him is really important. It may not matter in this one particular case at the immediate moment, but if you're trying to figure out where the conservative movement and legal conservatism is headed, he's a very a good person to keep an eye on. The political reason is that we have seen in the last 8 years two developments. One is the rise of this really strong white nationalist philosophy on the right and in the Republican Party. It was always there, but it's been really accentuated. And I think one of the things that's interesting about Thomas is from the very get-go, Donald Trump said that Clarence Thomas was his favorite Supreme Court justice. And it's the ways in which a pessimistic conservative Black nationalism can fit with a white nationalist philosophy. In recent years, we've begun to see the real political consequences of what I've just said. And that is, you're seeing a slow movement, it's not huge, of Black voters moving to the Republican Party to vote for Trump, and particularly Black male voters. When I have talked about this book in audiences, I can't tell you how often Black people in the audience will come up to me. They will say, "You are describing my father when you were talking about Clarence Thomas." I think Thomas speaks for a certain kind of Black male, often older voter, who is very disaffected with the failure to achieve racial equality and Black emancipation in this country. And he speaks to a kind of souring on the possibilities of racial progressivism. And so I think the reason why we should see Thomas as important is that, in a way, I don't want to say he is the face of the future. I think that's far too strong, but he is the face of a profound disaffection with racial progress and with Black politics altogether. And to that extent, he is, I think, not simply the most powerful Black writing voice in the country, but is speaking to a larger problem that America has had, which is what happens when Black freedom and Black equality no longer seems like a viable political vision for a group of people. And I think that's why he's important.
I just want to touch real quickly on some of the corruption allegations on Thomas. And you have said as well that that's also fairly consistent. Can you talk about that? Does that have to do with his ideas about money and speech?
Yeah. Thomas has, again, always been in the forefront on the question of money and speech. He believes profoundly that, particularly in a capitalist society, which he's a big believer in, that how we spend our money is an expression of what we believe and what we value and what we think. And this can get into some very technical, wonky stuff about the First Amendment and campaign finance and so forth. But he has developed a whole philosophy around that issue. So much so that when a lot of the corruption scandals broke recently, and I say broke somewhat in quotes because these stories have long been known. They were reported in the Los Angeles Times back in the aughts, but the scale of it was really not known until recently. But when I read those stories, you know, they are very consistent with his philosophy that in a capitalist democracy where money is speech, the wealthiest people are going to have the most access, the most impact. Their speech is going to be the weightiest, not because it's the smartest, not because it's the most correct, but because it has the most money behind it. And so you can, you know, accuse him of many things in those corruption scandals. And I think corruption is the right word. But hypocrisy, I don't think will cut it. I think it's very consistent with the kinds of things he has said over the years.
All right. We've been speaking with Corey Robin, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Robin will give a presentation entitled Clarence Thomas's Radical Race Politics and the Future of the Supreme Court at the University of Wisconsin Center for the Humanities on Thursday, April 24th at 5 p.m. in the Elvium Building, 800 University Avenue.
Belle Case La Follette was born 166 years ago today on April 21st, 1859. Although best known today as the spouse of Wisconsin's famous progressive senator Fighting Bob La Follette, she was also a great activist in her own right. In her day, she was a suffragist and a civil rights and peace activist. She was also a writer-editor for La Follette's magazine, known today as The Progressive. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
Today, April 21st, is the birthday of Belle Case La Follette, born in 1859. She was a suffragist, civil rights and peace activist, and writer-editor of La Follette's magazine. Later, The Progressive. She grew up on a family farm in Baraboo within a Unitarian family that encouraged her education and paid for her tuition to attend UW-Madison. When she married Bob La Follette on December 31st, 1881, the pair asked the minister to admit Obey from the ceremony. Belle became a vice principal in Baraboo, while Bob became a lawyer, running successfully for Dane County District Attorney. Belle became the first woman graduate of UW Law School in 1885. She never practiced law, but became a legal and political advisor to her husband, Bob. In the 1890s, she wrote a legal brief that broke new legal ground and won a case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In 1909, Belle became active in the suffragist movement in the state and nationally. She urged women to recognize problems viewed as personal within a political context. She wrote, "How much we pay for coal, food, and clothing is very largely determined by the control of natural resources, the tariff, the distribution tax, and by the regulation of the great private monopolies and freight rates." Belle thought launching a magazine would be too time-consuming and expensive, but once Bob began La Follette's magazine in 1909, published today as The Progressive, Belle devoted herself to making it a meaningful voice of progressivism. Belle's causes included appointing women as university regents, allowing women to keep their original names when marrying, criminalizing false advertising of drugs, Montessori schools, stopping corporal punishment for children, and sex education. She called capital punishment a survival of barbarism whose existence is contrary to the best thought and practice of modern civilization. Belle La Follette was a major force in gaining the vote for women in 1912 Belle La Follette remembered, I spoke 7 days a week in succession, usually 3 or 4 times a day, sometimes 6 or 8. During one 12-day tour, she gave 31 speeches in 14 different counties. Once at Rusk County Fairgrounds, she said, Oh, men of Wisconsin, don't you go back on me. If you should, I should be so disappointed and so humiliated for our state. Belle marched in the Great Suffrage Parade in New York City. On May 4th, 1912, she spoke before the Senate Committee on Women's Suffrage and met in a delegation with President Roosevelt, but neither effort worked, so La Follette took her case to the people. In summer 1914, she spoke for 63 consecutive days in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. The Senate finally approved the suffrage amendment on June 4th, 1919, with Belle La Follette observing, From the visitors' gallery, we shed a few tears, she wrote, noting that Wisconsin was the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. In 1930, the National League of Women Voters honored 71 women, including Belle, for their work for women's suffrage. A famous contemporary, Alice Paul, called La Follette the most consistent supporter of equal rights for all women of her time. Belle La Follette was known in the African-American community as a leader for racial equality. Beginning in 1913, she wrote a series of searing articles decrying the Wilson administration's plan to racially segregate federal services. She supported African-American rights to equal access to public accommodations, such as streetcars. She spoke before large African-American crowds, garnering front-page headlines in the Washington Post. In 1914, she spoke at the NAACP annual banquet in New York City, saying integration was in no way a matter of social privilege. It is a matter of civil rights. Belle was one of 3,000 women who formed the Women's Peace Party on January 10, 1915, which later became the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILF. Following the death of her husband in 1925, members of the Wisconsin legislature urged her to run to fill Bob's term. Instead, she urged her son, Robert, to run and became his campaign manager. Belle felt Robert's gender and age would make repeated re-elections possible, forwarding the progressive cause. Robert held office for 21 years. Belle kept the family magazine alive while also serving as chief advisor to both Robert Jr. and her son Phil, elected governor in 1930 and for 2 subsequent terms. La Follette also spoke out against the unjust treatment of Native Americans, saying it was an appalling reflection on our government and our civilization, adding, Any system that requires them to adopt the habits of the white race tends to undermine the health of the Indians frightfully and to make them unhappy, just as we would be if conditions were reversed. She championed absentee voting and campaigned to save the Children's Bureau. Only her death in 1931 brought an end to her activism. And that is our story for today. For The Past in the Past, I'm Harry Richardson.
The time right now is 6:52 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news right here on WORT.
Feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews 2 new features, one on the big screen and the other on the small screen. Harry says The Ballad of Wallace Island is a pleasant film about a quirky millionaire who just wants his 2 favorite musicians to reunite in a private concert. And on the small screen, Harry highly recommends North of North, a new comedy series that follows the indigenous people in the Arctic and makes some serious points along the way.
You made it, okay?
Is there not like a harbor?
It's sort of nature's harbor.
Welcome to Wallace Island.
No!
That was lit from the trailer for a sweet, melancholy indie, The Ballad of Wallace Island, directed by James Griffiths. It's expanded from a 2007 short film by writers-actors Tom Basden and Tim Key. The 2 British comedians play well off each other, with the welcome addition of Kerry Mulligan. Basden plays a frustrated folky, Herb McGuire. Herb takes a lucrative gig to play a one-night concert. Kay plays Charles, who has hired him. Charles is a lonely, eccentric motormouth who lives on his own island off Wales. The only other residents on the island are a quirky shopkeeper, Amanda, Cian, Clifford, and her son. Charles is superfan of the folk duo Maguire-Mortimer. Herb is immediately pulled off kilter by a drenching in the bay getting out of the rowboat, and to some extent he remains irritated and off balance for most of the film. Charles seems oblivious or puzzled by Herb's reactions. Charles lives in a huge home by himself after the death of his beloved spouse. Charles also invited Nell Mortimer Mulligan, the other half of the duo, upsetting Herb. Herb didn't realize Nell would be there. He's never gotten over their breakup. To make matters worse, Nell is happily married with her own small business. She, too, needs the money. Nell's spouse is a cheery American, Michael, a Kimji Nidfoyan. Michael is a bit of a birder and is disappointed not to see any birds on the island. Unfortunately for our story, he ships off to a nearby island to view Puffin for most of the film. Charles doesn't realize the awkward position he's put his two favorite musicians in. He just wants to hear them play together and would be delighted if this concert would get them together again musically. All in all, a well-done, melancholy movie with a fine cast and some touching scenes. It offers no real surprises, but it is a warm-hearted, pleasant film. Credit should go to the cinematographer G. Meganier Augustson for some striking shots in and off the island. It just started playing in local theaters. Up next, another pleasant diversion, this one also in an isolated spot with quirky people.
I am a modern Inuk woman. I got married out of high school, started a family. Hi. Now he's the town golden boy, and I'm his wife.
That was a clip from the trailer for North of North, a funny, warm-hearted, eight-part comedy series co-created by Inuit women who live in the Arctic. Stacy Aglock McDonald and Alethea Aanglock Barrow. Our story centers on the story of Siaya Anna Lambie, who lives in the mythical village of Ice Cove, Nunavut. Nunavut is a huge self-governing region of Canada run by the indigenous Inuit people. Siaya is stifled by her traditional relationship with her self-absorbed spouse, town golden boy Ting, Kelly Williams. She breaks up with him very publicly early in our first episode. She takes their sweet 7-year-old daughter, Bun, Kira Bell Cooper, with her. Her mother, Nevi, Micah Harper, is the opposite of warm and fuzzy. Nevi is doubtful that Siaya has made a good decision and tells her so. This is tough love. Siaya, who has never had a job but knows and loves her town, talks her way into the job of the assistant to the town manager, Helen. Helen, Mary Lynn Ruscub, a woman with a white savior vibe, really cares about the people of Ice Cove almost as much as getting credit for doing her job. Siaya has recently proved herself to be, in Helen's words, an adequate volunteer for the town spring celebration. Helen's other staffers are Millie Zorga Kwan Ah Q and Colin Bailey Poaching, who run the local radio station out of the rundown community center. The other staffer is Alaspi, a judgmental woman who only gradually warms up to Siaya. Further complicating Siaya's life is the appearance of Alistar, Jack Ryan, an environmental consultant in town, to see if Ice Cove is the suitable site for a new research center. It's not Alistar's first time in town. Another new arrival is his young aide, Kunk Brandon Clark, a good-looking city boy who has his own community connections. The city's early episodes are largely played for laughs, even a first episode cringy encounter, but we gradually see some serious encounters as well, like in episode 4, when an elder looks like he's there to complain about a recent party that ended badly, but Lazarus, Solomon Awa, instead begins by talking about how their people have endured hardship over the centuries in the harsh environment. Yes, practical skills are important, he tells Siaya, but so are the little joys of life. Episode 8 offers us a very satisfying conclusion to the series, which was filmed on location with 500 people of Iqaluit, the capital of Nunavut, as extras. North of North just started streaming on Netflix. I highly recommend it. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks so much for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Shayna Clark was your reporter. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Brian Standing and Harry Richardson. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production. Victor Calzoni engineered this show. Bay Park produced this newscast. And Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial. It's called The Access Hour. Have a great night.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Hello, everybody out there. We are VoltC from Madison, Wisconsin.